And W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Liberty Mutual Insurance.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Even as California gets a break in the weather, the state has seen over 500 mudslides, and the danger is not over. The soil is saturated, which increases the risk of landslides, mudslides, and sinkholes. CBS's Chris Van Cleve in Ventura County.
In Berkeley.
This is just all our backyard area.
Mud poured through Marjorie Cruz's home of more than 20 years, one of eight in the area deemed unlivable.
We just are at the mercy of this mud and hoping and praying and keeping our fingers crossed. That it doesn't take the rest of my house out.
Since New Year's, California has experienced more than 500 landslides spanning the entire state, from the mountains to the coast.
President Biden is traveling to California on Thursday to see the damage. A failed Republican candidate in New Mexico is accused of targeting his opponents and is under arrest, suspected of orchestrating shootings at the homes of four Democratic lawmakers. CBS's Scott McFarlane with more on Solomon Pena.
In their report, police say photos show Pena with one of the alleged accomplices and that individual with multiple guns and ammunition, and that Pena paid one of the shooters $500. The police report says Pena was unhappy with one of the shootings and asked the shooters to be more aggressive, to shoot lower into the houses, and to do so earlier in the evening when targets would less likely be laying down.
Ukrainian soldiers are now at Fort Sill in Oklahoma for training on the use and deployment of Patriot missiles, Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryan.
Training has begun, as we've talked about before. That training will last for several months and train upwards of 90 to 100 Ukrainians.
Russia says it will increase the number of troops from the current 1.1 million to 1.5 million in coming years. Some of it is due to troop losses in its war with Ukraine. And as CBS's Deborah Patta explains,
one of the plans we understand is that there will be bases set up in parts of Europe, particularly looking on the border near Finland. And as you remember, last year, Finland was expressed its intent to join NATO. That decision has not been finalized.
Michael Cohen, the former attorney and fixer for Donald Trump, has met with investigators from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. CBS's Graham Cates reports.
Cohen's interview comes 4 days after two Trump Organization companies were sentenced to pay a combined $1.6 million stemming from a December conviction on 17 criminal counts related to tax fraud.
When do we want it?
Now!
Some educators at the University of Illinois at Chicago are on strike. Major contract sticking points include pay and more funding for student services. On Wall Street, the Dow closed down 392 points. This is CBS News.
Nobody should have to pay for one-size-fits-all insurance coverage. Liberty Mutual customizes your car and home insurance so you only pay for what you need. Liberty Mutual Insurance.
The Sha 101 FM, your fix for progressive talk. From Butler to Windlake. Always streaming at waukradio.com.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Madner with your headlines. Forever chemicals first found in municipalities' drinking water are now showing up in fresh fish pulled from the Great Lakes. A new study in the Environmental Research Journal finds that eating freshwater fish harvested from urban areas 12 times a year can more than triple the level of PFOS in people. PFOS are one of the most well-known and researched compounds of PFAS. PFAS are man-made chemicals used for water and stain-resistant qualities in things like clothing and carpet, nonstick cookware, packaging, and firefighting foam. Governor Evers expected to appoint former state Senator John Urbanbach to lead the parole commission. Democrat announced in December 2021 he wouldn't seek re-election after serving the 27th Senate District for 24 years. Urbanbach can't serve in the role without confirmation unless the chamber votes to reject him. You're listening to The Sha, 101 FM, WAUK, 540 AM.
It's a new year, and because we're excited about our new and still growing Civic Media network of radio stations, it's time to do something really big. How does a $1 million advertising giveaway sound to you? Our celebration is your chance to work with Civic Media's amazing sales team, creating a radio advertising campaign promoting your business for free. Save the date. The $1 million advertising giveaway is only happening on Thursday, January 26th. Full details on our website, civicmedia.us/million.
Hey, this is Jim Santel. I am the host of Morning Cannolis.
Every single Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m., we talk about the major stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. Delighted to have you join, call in, and be a part of our discussion right here on the networks of Civic Media.
Up North News Radio is Wisconsin's new choice for progressive talk about important state issues, from the team that brings you the news through social media, newsletters, and here on the radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Join me weekday mornings from 6 to 8 a.m.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
The Shaw, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM, Wisconsin's home for rational talk radio. A progressive voice for rural Wisconsin, WAUK 540 AM, always streaming at WAUK.
At TheRickSmithShow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I made the very important call to my daughter who has a gas stove just to make sure she still has it. The stove police, the stove troopers have not kicked in the front door and stolen her stove and her furnace. It's still there, amazingly, remarkably. Because if you listen to the news last week, stove troopers were teaming up with MS-13 to steal your stoves. They were coming for it. And you had politicians saying, "For my cold, dead hands." Yeah. That's how ludicrous this whole thing has become. And look, nobody. Was talking about taking your stove. Nobody. They were simply saying, hey, there's some risks here. Maybe we should talk about it. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on just how ludicrous last week was and how it all filters. Because this is one of those exercises, and take a look at what the right-wing machine can do with even the most ridiculous of stories and how they can feed the outrage candy to the masses. I've asked my good friend Craig Harrington to come talk with us. Craig is the research director over at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org, their website. Craig, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I look at this story. Do you still have your, let's start there. Did they come for your gas stove? Had they kicked in your door and stolen your stove?
My wife and I do have a gas stove and oven, and it still remains installed in the house. I used it to make some impossible burgers tonight, which I imagine the right wing would also be upset about. I'm definitely going to steal stove troopers, though, from now on. I had never heard that or thought of that. That's a moment of zen that I'll definitely keep with me from this, conversation, Rick.
No, the reality is look, they're masterful at creating this sense of urgency that there's an evil entity out there. The evil empire is coming for your stuff, and it's you. They're coming. They're going to kick in your door and steal from you. And look, people don't want to be taken from. People are as bad as gas stoves may be for you, they want to hold on to them. Ronnie Jackson with his cold, dead hands.
Yeah. And for a sort of primer here for your listeners and for your audience, last week, right-wing media broadly, though some members of mainstream media and some even sort of erstwhile liberal pundits joined in on the fray, but really right-wing media melted down last week after a report from the Consumer Product Safety Commission was released, in which that agency announced considerations for new guidelines and regulations on gas stoves, citing the health concerns that gas stoves create for other residents inside that domicile. It's important to think about what this report was not. This was not a ban. This was not the Consumer Product Safety Commission proposing a ban on gas stoves, a recall on gas stoves. There are no stove troopers going house to house ripping them out of your walls. This was a report encouraging markets to voluntarily strengthen their own standards. This is something that lots of regulatory agencies do and actually have a great deal of success with. In the American consumer market, you catch more flies with honey, right? These agencies, these regulatory bodies that are tasked with protecting American consumers and the American public will sometimes release reports like this, that are really directed at manufacturers and market makers, and in this case, home builders, who purchase large numbers of gas stoves. And what they're pointing out is that there are these fairly considerable health risks for people who live in a domicile with a gas stove, which are not focused on climate, not focused on methane emissions. It has nothing to do with the Green New Deal. This was specifically the negative health effects associated across the population if you live in a home with a gas stove. And for an individual, the risks are very low, but across the broad market space of the American economy, the risks compound and aggregate, and you actually do have significant health challenges that are created by living in a house with these emissions, specifically carbon monoxide emissions from the unburnt methane gas that goes through the pipes. Carbon monoxide is very poisonous. In low doses, it's very poisonous, and it can be poisonous over very long term. It's not just, you know, going to sleep and never waking up again because of acute poisoning overnight. You can have systemic poisoning from carbon monoxide accumulating over years and years and years with negative health effects, similar to like lead paint, right. Which was another issue that the market really moved on after government regulators made a point of highlighting how dangerous this was for construction companies and for home builders and for people who had people living inside of residences that they were responsible for. You then might be responsible for some of these negative health effects as well. And so this report comes out, and what we saw immediately was overzealous right-wing responses with exaggerated claims that this was part of the Green New Deal, that this was part of the global warming agenda. And of course, there was faux outrage from lots of people, left and right, but very predominantly on the right, about the supposed impossibility of using an electric stove in place of gas stove. And I can tell you, almost anyone who's grown up in a home that was on the lower half of the income bracket, they probably had an electric stovetop. They're much cheaper. Yep. And so if you grew up in a working class family, a lower middle class family like I did, we had electric stoves. We also eventually moved to a gas range. But you can use gas and electric virtually interchangeably for most things, unless you're like searing a marshmallow or trying to blister a red bell pepper. Almost everything that you are going to cook on a daily basis, you can do on gas or electric. And electric is much safer and much cheaper, and there are no ancillary health effects. And so the government regulators were recommending that the markets move toward those. Yeah. And of course, what we saw was a cacophony of complaints from right-wing media who knew better. They knew they were exaggerating this, but it was something that created a culture war. And really, this, you sort of alluded to this, right-wing actors, the media and political echo chamber, they kind of need these test cases to kind of get their reps in, right? Like they create faux outrage around these things, like the color, like how long the green M&M's boots are in the cartoon. That's a thing that right-wing media really focus on to get their reps. Like they need to figure out how to stir the pot and how to generate outrage. And they take these opportunities to run with the ball. And unfortunately, what we saw in the case of the gas stoves was lots of mainstream outlets, lots of individuals sort of like spouting off on Twitter, kind of got sucked into this. And when the facts are, like, electric stoves are just safer. They're also safer to cook with. They're safer to have in your home, in addition to not carrying methane and carbon monoxide poisoning.
Yeah, I haven't heard of anyone, you know, leaving the stove on and then the house blowing up with an electric stove. Haven't heard that, but have heard that, as you know, with the gas stoves. Now, what's interesting is you brought up lead paint a moment ago, and last week I had talked about, you know, if this were, you know, 40 years ago when we were dealing with asbestos or lead paint, wouldn't, you know, Matt Gaetz and Ronnie Jackson, you know, wrap themselves in a blanket of asbestos going, oh, look how warm this is, or have, you know, Virginia Fox or Marsha Blackburn say, oh, how dare you deny my children, you know, those lead paint chips before dinner. You know, this kind of mass insanity without going, can't we have a serious conversation about what really affects our health? The sad reality is no.
Yeah, and it's totally plausible. You're pointing out, would someone, a member of Congress, have wrapped themselves in an asbestos blanket? Honestly, maybe. You know, we all remember, maybe we don't all remember, hopefully people don't have the brain poisoning that I have from living in this right-wing media echo chamber, but when Ted Cruz's response to a nationwide conversation about recalling assault rifles and banning the future sales of assault rifles was to wrap bacon around the muzzle of an AR-15 and cook what he called machine gun bacon, using the muzzle flash from repeated firing of the AR-15 to sear the bacon as it was wrapped around the muzzle of an assault rifle. This is literally an instrument of death that's used on the battlefield to cripple and kill soldiers so that they actually become, so that as combat casualties, they become more and more burdensome for the army that is fielding them and having to take care of them as they return from the battlefield with gruesome injuries. And he was cooking bacon with it. That's how unserious they are about something as deadly serious as assault rifles.
Yeah.
So no. would they be totally out of pocket with this gas stoves thing? Absolutely.
No, and it's amazing. So then you take this, something as ludicrous as this. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show with Craig Harrington. He's a Media Matters research director, mediamatters.org, the website, if you want to check out the work that they do. So if we take this ludicrous issue and how they've blown this way out of proportion, when it comes to something serious, like this week, you know, we're heading towards a technical limit on our debt. I mean, Janet Yellen has said this week we're going to bump up against what they're saying is a technical limit, which I thought we were going to be at least decent until August. When we get to this, what kind of insane rhetoric are we going to get? Because I truly believe there are people now in our halls of Congress who, to use a better analogy, want to shoot the hostage. They want to default. They want to see what happens when we don't pay our bills. I truly believe that.
Yeah. So this debt ceiling conversation, for anyone who has followed politics in the last decade or so, the debt ceiling has become a sort of rote mechanism that is expected to be used when Republicans are in power and a Democrat is in the White House. The expectation is that Republicans will do whatever they can to run up against the debt ceiling, refuse to raise the debt ceiling, misinform the public about what the debt ceiling is. You often see household analogies. Kevin McCarthy was on Fox News earlier today talking about how if your child continued to max out the credit card, you wouldn't keep raising the credit limit for them. You would eventually stop paying for it and teach them a lesson. But that's actually somewhat of a deadbeat lesson. Kevin McCarthy is a member of Congress. He's the one who appropriates the funds. He's the one who chose to spend all of this money. He's a congressional leader. The president is forced to spend money that Congress sends them. This is like if you work in an office place when you have an invoice for like your office equipment. You have to spend it or you lose that appropriation. You have to spend the money. You're obligated to do so. The president isn't the one who ran up the debt. Congress is the one who ran up the debt through their appropriations for funding of projects, many of which are entirely valid and worthwhile. It's not all F-35s. Most of what we spend government money on is social services, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then there's also discretionary funding for absolutely vital anti-poverty relief programs. What Kevin McCarthy is proposing and what Fox News and their echo chamber continue to promote, particularly the biggest proponent of crashing through the debt ceiling at Fox News is Sean Hannity. What they are proposing is to use up your credit card all the way to the limit, take all that stuff home, and then refuse to pay the bills and get that stuff repossessed, get taken to court and lose your house and have your wages garnished. And that is somehow supposed to teach a lesson in fiscal responsibility. It is totally absurd. The core concept of the debt ceiling argument is built on a lie. And before 2011, before the Tea Party Revolution, when Republicans swept through in control of Congress, this control of the House of Representatives, no one had ever seriously had a conversation about refusing to raise the debt ceiling and defaulting on the national debt. In 2011, the United States did not enter technical default, but it was the first time the Treasury Department ever had to enter what was called extraordinary measures, moving around money through accounting gimmicks, not funding certain forms of long-term government investments so that they could have the cash flow to keep the government open and to make all of their pay all of their obligations on a daily basis. The government had its credit rating downgraded by Standard and Poor's in 2011. And that single downgrade actually cost the government $1.3 billion that year, with more costs in the out years. So these ostensible fiscal conservatives, these Republicans and their right-wing media allies who wanted to cut government spending, forced the Treasury to spend an extra $1.3 billion out of thin air just to service the debt that we had already incurred. Whether or not the government ought to have a balanced budget, that's a debate for economists. And it's actually a debate that we had in the 90s, if anyone remembers. The government had such surpluses that there was considerable worry from conservative and liberal economists that there wasn't enough treasuries out there circulating in the economy, that the American debt, the American budget surplus was actually going to hurt the global economy, and we needed to start going into debt again. That was a real conversation that like Larry Summers and Alan Greenspan had in public 20 years ago. People have just forgotten about it. But now we've gone through so many iterations of this debt ceiling brinkmanship that the only thing left is what you said, shooting the hostage. John Boehner knew that we couldn't go into default. He didn't want to go into default. Paul Ryan knew that we couldn't go into default, and he didn't want to go into default. It's not clear that Kevin McCarthy actually knows that he is that he's not telling the truth. And the sad thing is he has so few votes as a majority in Congress for his speakership. He just fought for a week to become speaker. He was totally humiliated in the public. It became a media spectacle. Is he going to throw away his speakership, avoiding a national default on our sovereign debt? He's fought his whole life to do this. This is literally his only accomplishment as a politician, is getting elected Speaker of the House. Is he going to throw it away so that Jim Jordan can usurp him, or so that Matt Gaetz can toss him out of Congress, all over
not likely.
As silly as not defaulting?
Not likely. But can I spin a different narrative? Because,
please.
You know, you said that, you know, the way that they see it is, you know, they'll come and repossess the House and do all this stuff and all the negative stuff that we know probably will happen. The alternative narrative is, look at Donald Trump. You can file bankruptcy several times and you're still rich. You just stiff somebody else. You know, this is someone else's problem. So the narrative that I see is they're saying, well, it's not going to affect us. You know, screw those poor people in other countries. Screw those poor people. You know, we can do this like Trump has gotten away with. Do you see that as part of this conversation?
We're sort of speed running the conversation that we really had that was much more earnest in 2013 and 2015. What we saw then was this proposition from Republicans in Congress, and it was really begun by Fox News pundits, and then it filtered its way into the Republicans in Congress, was this idea of doing prioritized payments so that the government wouldn't fully default on all of its debt. It wouldn't pay any of its foreign creditors, and it would just pay domestic creditors. So the government has, you know, $30 trillion worth of debt. The number is actually immaterial. It doesn't really matter what the number is. And human brains can really only conceive of a number like up to the number 20, you know, like the number after 19. So 30 trillion is a magical number to any human being. No, you're not Einstein. No one knows what that number even is. But so the government has $30 trillion worth of debt, but like 60% of it is owed to Americans, to American companies and American individuals. I own some treasury bonds as part of my retirement. Most people who have diversified retirement portfolios own treasury bonds. And what the Republicans have proposed, and what has been proposed by right-wing media pundits, particularly conservative economic pundits that you see on Fox and elsewhere, is this idea that you would just pay the American creditors and ignore the foreign creditors. The problem is that the foreign creditors are not only, they're not just random people. Some of them are huge sovereign wealth funds and very powerful governments, China, Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom. And if we didn't pay them the debts that we owe them, we would shut down their commercial debt markets and potentially send them into an economic tailspin. The United States refusing to pay the treasury obligations we owe China would be tantamount to war.
Yeah, but here's the thing.
It would be,
see, here's the thing.
It
this, would be is where war. I, this is where I use the analogy of shooting the hostage. They want to touch the button. It was like Trump when he was in the White House, wanted to drop a nuke. This is that thing. They tell us bad things can happen. Let's see. It's like a child. You tell a child, don't touch the hot stove. They got to touch it. This is what the debt ceiling has become for them. It's that hot stove. They got, with their cold dead hands, they got to touch it.
And there are so few people left who are serious policymakers on the elected side, and there are so few honest brokers left in the media component as well, that we're just at a point where there isn't really anybody to pull them back from the brink. In the past, it actually had been Mitch McConnell. During unified Republican control of government in 2018, the Republicans had the longest government shutdown in history. And there was a conversation during that shutdown period about potentially going up against the debt ceiling and defaulting on the debt. And the person who had to bring us back from the brink then was Mitch McConnell. But he was working with unified Republican government, and they still screwed up masterfully and shut down the government for a month. Is he going to be able to broker the same sort of compromise from the minority in this situation, particularly when Matt Iglesias, who's a liberal writer, he was asking on Twitter, I think last night or two nights ago, what the non-cynical explanation for Republican behavior and for the media behavior? What's a non-cynical explanation for wanting to crash the debt ceiling and blow up the economy? And what I thought in response to that was, there isn't a non-cynical explanation.
There isn't.
They want draconian cuts. They want to damage the economy They just want it to happen to a Democratic president.
Yep. The cruelty. But as I say all the time, cruelty is the point.
Yeah.
The fact that this will be cruel, this will be painful, this will hurt. That really is kind of the point. So last question real quick. How long does this go? Do you think we're really going to come August end up defaulting?
This is really difficult to tell. If I could predict the future, I'd be a very wealthy person and in a different line of work. And so all caveats aside, if you look at the way investment markets are actually reacting to this debt ceiling, not how Bloomberg is reporting it, but actually how the markets are responding, is they now think this is kind of commonplace. We've done this so many times that the investors don't think we're going to crash through. But of course, if you're an investor, if you're a professional market maker, you can't conceive of a world where the United States would default on the sovereign debt. The entire industry would just cease to exist. We've seen analyses that were saying that you could see $15 trillion erased from the economy. That would be, you know, tantamount to six or seven times the COVID crash that we saw in March of 2020, just on the stock markets, just in the United States. The analysts don't think it's going to happen. The media, particularly mainstream analysts, are increasingly worried about it. And liberal pundits really do think, like, Kevin McCarthy could do this. And of course, we know Media Matters just published something about this today, 48 individual instances just of Sean Hannity since 2011 calling for shutting down the government and crashing through the debt ceiling. 48 times,
wow.
Seven of them in the past week, 40 other times in his past life during previous presidencies, including during the Trump administration, when he still wanted to do this kind of stuff. The right-wing echo chamber wants to touch the button. They want to touch the stove. It does seem like House Republican leadership wants to at least try to do so. Will we default? I honestly don't know. But the fact that I don't know is shocking, because it could literally erase the American economy.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. But Craig, I appreciate the time. As this continues, and it will, I hope you'll come back and share some more thoughts with us. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Craig Herrington, Media Matters Research Director. Make sure you check out the work that they do over at mediamatters.org. We'll get links out on social media. Crazy stuff. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Fan of the show, you've heard our Labor History in Two segments, and you can hear them on the radio pretty much anywhere in the U.S. Labor history has never been more important than it is right now. So here's what we'd like you to do. Tell a teacher. Tell a teacher that labor history is important and that they can get digestible two-minute lessons that are absolutely free. Free to download, free to use, free to share. Tell a teacher to go to thericksmithshow.com/history and help us put labor back where it belongs, in the classroom. You know, generations of American workers fought, bled, and died to build the American way of life. It's our job to keep their stories alive. Go tell a teacher that we're here to help them do just that. Find us at thericksmithshow.com/history today.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm curious if everyone thinks that, you know, Marjorie Trainwreck Greene, Lauren Boebert with her GED, Matt Gaetz, if they really, you know, Jim Jordan, Scott, pardon me, Perry. I mean, if these are the people that represent the whole of the nation on this issue. I mean, this is a big one. This is a big issue. If we default on our obligations, as Craig Herrington said, it could send ripples across not just our economy, but across the globe. And, you know, look, there are some people, and this is where the weird part is, there are some people who want a massive, painful correction, if you will, you know, to get working people back, you know, get them back where, you know, in line. You know, working for poverty wages and desperation. So I'm curious your thoughts. Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Tell me what you think. Are we heading towards this kind of world? Could we possibly default? And is this something you'd support? Is this something?
The Shah 101 FM, Franklin's choice for news talk radio. Streaming 24/7 at waukradio.com.
CBS News Brief. 41 of California's 58 counties have seen storm damage in the last few weeks due to atmospheric rivers. President Biden will head to California on Thursday to tour the damage.
We're all closely monitoring the storms, the floods, the landslides all across California. And our heart is with all the families in the communities that are hurting.
A Republican candidate in New Mexico is accused of targeting his opponents and is under arrest, suspected of orchestrating shootings at the homes of four Democratic lawmakers. CBS's Scott McFarlane.
Police say in one of the shootings, a state legislator's 10-year-old daughter woke up to bullet debris falling on her head.
Ukrainian soldiers are now at Fort Sill in Oklahoma to be trained on the use and deployment of Patriot missiles. More from CBS's David Martin.
Defense against the Russian missile barrages being unleashed against Kyiv, Dnipro, and other cities is Ukraine's most pressing need. But the Pentagon says the training on the high-tech Patriots will take several months.
CBS News Brief, I'm Jennifer Kuiper.
Bringing some sanity to the airwaves. The Shah 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
For Civic Media, I'm Terry Bell with this news. Wisconsin Republicans want to put welfare on April ballot statewide. The Senate takes up the advisory referendum bill today. The proposed question would ask if able-bodied childless adults should have to look for work in order to get public benefits. It hardly matters since jobless Wisconsinites already have to look for work to get food stamps and unemployment. The move is seen as a way to drive voter turnout for conservatives running for state Supreme Court. Dozens of people are pressing state lawmakers to keep the UW-Platteville campus in Richland Center open. State Senator Howard Markwein tells Civic Media he wants to keep the campus open, but says the university's president didn't ask him. The Richland campus is set to close at the end of the spring semester. In sports, the Bucks host Toronto tonight. You're listening to The Shah, 101 FM, WAUK 540 AM.
Women hear a lot about self-care these days. Advice on ways to relax, exercise, eat healthy, and more. Those are all great. But one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. That means saving money for retirement. It's never too late to start. And it's the kind of self-care that brings peace of mind that lasts. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. That's WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
I'm Pat Kreitlow from Up North News. On an earlier edition, we talked to three women, med students, about whether they're going to stay in Wisconsin to practice medicine.
All this Roe v. Wade stuff, and now OBGYN's hands are so tied. I don't want to go through 12 years of training to have some person that didn't do training tell me how to do my job.
It is not a binary choice. You're for or against abortion. It is a healthcare decision. We all have those stories, and people want to hear them.
Don't miss the real stories here on Up North News.
27% of the American workforce, and some even say 30%, were in unions who had representation and who clearly did not have to worry about whether or not they were going to get their fair share. But I'm definitely going to fight for people who get the short end of the stick in this society only because they don't have representation. That's who I am.
Check out the Earl Ingram Show every day from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. only on WAUK 540 a.m. 101 FM, The Shaw.
Women get a lot of advice about self-care these days, but one of the most important self-care steps we can take is making sure we're financially secure later in life. For small steps you can take to save for retirement, visit WeSaySaveIt.org. A message from AARP and the Ad Council.
They are silly, and also because they're attacking the future. To work for yard sanity and choice, go to rewild.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you may remember, I think it was last month we were talking about this. The city of Cleveland, the city council in Cleveland passed an ordinance on wage theft. It was the Wage Theft and Payroll Fraud Prevention Ordinance. Say that 10 times fast. But the idea was, is maybe we protect low-wage workers from being cheated, because we know, according to FBI statistics, if you add up all of the bank robberies, all the gas station stick-ups, all of the robberies in this country, still nowhere near the amount of wage theft. Wage theft is a major crime in this country that never gets prosecuted. Well, maybe we've now got some ordinances that are going to move us in a direction to start holding folks accountable. So over the weekend, there was an op-ed over at Cleveland.com that caught my attention, titled Protect Workers from Wage Theft. And I've decided to ask one of the co-authors of the piece to come talk with us. Allie Smith is a Worker Center Network liaison with Policy Matters Ohio, their website, policymattersohio.org. Allie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, you know, I'm looking at this ordinance, and I'm going, you know, this is about damn time, because what we know from FBI statistics is all the things we see on the evening news, all the bank robberies, all the gas station stick-ups, all the convenience stores, all that stuff, pale in comparison to the massive ripoff that happens to working people every day.
That's right. And, you know, some of the research that kind of supported this and helped people in power see that this is something we need to protect people from is really shocking. Like you're saying, in Ohio, the average victim of minimum wage non-payment, so that's just one type of wage theft where you're not getting paid the legal minimum wage. The average worker that experiences that kind of wage theft loses $2,900 a year, which is a quarter of their pay. So some of the lowest paid people doing these essential jobs are losing a quarter of their pay to wage theft. If a worker stole $2,900 from their employer, that would be a felony.
Oh, yeah. They'd put them under the jail. Probably.
Exactly. So but workers are experiencing that every day with very little protection. And, you know, I work closely with the Ohio Worker Centers. There's one in Cincinnati, one in Columbus, and one in Cleveland now. And this is what they really, their bread and butter is educating people about this, working with people to teach them their rights, first of all, to make sure they know their rights in the workplace, and then connecting them with resources to be made whole. And it's unbelievable. The most common thing that we hear when we educate people about wage theft is, oh, that's happened to me. I didn't know what to call it. I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So it's really
See, this
endemic.
Is where this Everywhere. Is where Allie, I go, it's never happened to me. Because I've always had a union job.
There you go. That's right.
For me, the Minimum Wage Protection Act, the Wage Protection Act should be the Union Enforcement Act. Get people organized so that in the workplace they have the power to stand up and say, hey, you cheated me, without fear of reprisal and being fired. Now, in your piece, I found it really interesting because I like using that statistic that you can, you know, round up all of the stick-em-up kind of robberies, and it's pales in comparison to wage theft. You did some of this in your piece where you pointed out in Cleveland, if you filled up the Cavs Stadium, the Brown Stadium, the Guardian Stadium, and every high school football stadium in the area, it still wouldn't be the 213,000 people who were cheated out of minimum wage violations in the previous year. I think that shows I like the vision. The visual, if you will.
Yeah, I think we get caught up. Sometimes these numbers are so big, they're hard to get your arms around. I mean, that's just one kind of wage theft. So that's a huge, anybody who's been to one of those sports teams, you can picture that packed stadium, every single one of those people losing money they earned to feed their families, to pay their rent or their mortgage, to put gas in the tank. And it's not fair. I think Ohioans of all backgrounds can get together on that. It's fair to get paid for the hours you work.
Absolutely. And the thing that's interesting for me, and this is why everyone should care about this, is because there's a trickle-down effect. As these workers get cheated out of wages, they then become more heavily dependent on social programs that are, sure, you know, underfunded already. And it becomes this kind of what's the reward for work? We hear people say, no one wants to work anymore. Nobody wants to work for poverty wages in desperate conditions and throw on top of that being stolen from every week.
That's right. And, you know, you mentioned unions. There's data to back you up. Being a member of a union is one of the best ways to fight against wage theft or protect yourself against wage theft.
Yeah, I don't need data, but, Allie. I don't need the data. I've lived it. I was a poor kid growing up on the in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. That union card I carry in my wallet has given me the ability to do things I could have never imagined as a poor kid. And this is one of those things where I want people to be able, through their labor, to lift themselves up. I believe in that. The problem is we've been letting these criminals at the top, these people sitting in our boardrooms, rob us blind.
Yes, and it's, you know, some of it's really basic. Like in Ohio, we don't have protections that require all workers to get a pay stub so they can even see what's happening to their pay. Like there's some really basic things we can do to protect people. And when we allow employers to criminally underpay people, right, by not paying them time and a half for overtime, not paying a minimum wage, just straight not paying them for a job that they completed. That happens a lot in the construction industry. When we allow that to happen, it hurts good businesses that are above board, trying to do right by their employees, not breaking the law. It makes it harder for them too. And it hurts all workers. So even if this hasn't happened to you, it's still an issue that's important and that affects you in some way.
No, it's an excellent point. I think one we don't talk enough about because there are good employers out there who want to do the right thing. But sadly, you've got these bottom feeders who are pulling everyone down. And this is why we need regulation. This is why we need enforcement. Why an ordinance like this wage theft ordinance is so important. And I hope this spreads like wildfire across the country to where, you know, maybe we make this the same kind of crime as stealing 3 peppermint patties from a store and spending a year and waiting for trial like they did, like the guy in Philadelphia. This is one of those things where let's start locking up the real criminals.
Yeah, and there are more communities looking to do something like this, and it's going to look different depending on the community and, you know, if it's a city or a county or a statewide push. But the ordinance in Cleveland is so good because it's built on this really simple premise. The people in Cleveland pay taxes into the city of Cleveland budget. So the people of Cleveland should not be paying to do business with corporations that steal from their employees. Like, period. There's not an argument.
Yeah.
You can't build an argument against this. This is not a partisan thing or you have some good points on this side and you have some good points on this side. Like
There's no both sidesism here.
No.
Either you're doing what you're supposed to do or you're not.
That's right.
You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Allie Smith. She's the Worker Center Network liaison for the folks over at Policy Matters Ohio. PolicyMattersOhio.org, their website, if you want to check out the work that they do. Also, the piece over at Cleveland.com, Protect Ohio Workers from Wage Theft. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Because, you know, this is, again, one of these things we're told. You know, I go back to being a kid, you know, hearing Ronald Reagan saying, you know, the best anti-poverty program is a job. And I agree with him. I have amended that to say the best anti-poverty program is a union job, because you're not going to get cheated out of wages and you're going to get a fair share of the wealth that your labor creates. But I like the idea. But if we continue to allow people to get away with these crimes, that pathway up isn't there. And I like the fact that the Biden administration has done something on the federal level to do some of this as well. So it seems like there should be an all hands on deck pathway to protecting working people if we can't get them in unions right away.
Yeah. So we definitely, the worker centers are really focused on folks who are not, for whatever reason, covered by a union agreement yet, hopefully. But, you know, we see cases all the time of just egregious behavior. It's not a disagreement or a he said, she said. It's like, I did a drywall job for you. I quoted you $6,000. You paid me $3,000 up front. I completed the job. I did good work with my skills. And then you ghosted me.
Yeah.
There's no, I don't have the money for an attorney to go after that $3,000. I'm going to spend more than I can get. Like, what do I do? I'm just stuck. How do I pay people? Or, you know, people whose bosses, they're making the tipped minimum wage and their bosses are taking some of their tip money. People who are asked to show up to work and get ready for an hour, do an hour of work to get ready for their shift before they clock in. Like, we can't, I think all of us can agree that that's some bullshit, and we can't allow that kind of treatment of people who are our neighbors and friends and colleagues.
I agree with you. Now, you brought up something, the drywall job, because, you know, when most people think of minimum wage violations, when they think of wage theft, you know, it's you know, it's traditional kind of employment. You know, have you looked at what happens in the gig world? Because, you know, I'm told it's much worse in the gig world, because your example of doing the drywall job, you know, I see the TikTok videos. I see all of the, you know, the people saying, you know, this person, you know, basically stole this from me and I have no recourse. So how much of this, of your study and your work is just on you know, people in traditional employment and people in the quote unquote new brave new world?
Yeah, I mean, gig employees are further disenfranchised, right? Like, the companies try to say, oh, you have more flexibility. This is, you know, there are benefits to this kind of work, but really they're kind of methodically stripping away the rights that workers have fought and died for over, you know, the 250 years of America. Like, we, what do I want to say? You have to be educated about your rights. You have to know what your rights are to know when they're being violated.
Right.
So there's some work to be done there around know your rights. There's also some work to be done that lots of these people who get exploited by these bad employers are undocumented, or are have dealt with the criminal justice system, or have these other things that are kind of making them targets or making them vulnerable. But all of those, we all have rights. If you're working, you have some rights. It doesn't matter, you know, what employers try to use to divide us. Everybody has some base level rights.
Right.
And of course, labor law is like, I mean, a beast. But that's why worker centers are so important, because they can help people just learn their rights and figure out what's the right next step for me. What does that look like? And kind of walk them through the process. So that's what gets me up in the morning, is these cases where we have somebody come in who can't make rent because they got some of their wages stolen, and we're able to connect them with the right resource for that employer to pay up. And then that worker, that's not ever the end of the story, right? That worker always goes on more empowered and more knowledgeable, and helps other workers and other friends. And it's kind of like the beginning of organizing to come together with your coworkers and work for a better, better workplace, better safety, and better treatment.
No, that's fantastic. So last line of questioning, because you've hit on where I wanted to end with this, is, you know, if you feel you're being cheated, if you feel that something, you know, like this has happened to you, what do you do? Because, you know, you're dealing with, you need the job, you need the money, you know, and as you've said, you know, the people that are being cheated most often are the most vulnerable. So they're usually the ones who are used to getting kicked around. What's the advice for somebody? What's the way forward for them?
Here's a few easy things. First of all is keep some records. This is not something that is glamorous, and sometimes it's a pain in the butt, but what we've seen in these wage theft cases that go to you know, either a private attorney or a state or federal agency, is that a little bit of record keeping goes a long way. So if you have, you know, you need to know the name of your employer. You need to know how much you were supposed to be paid, the hours you work. So any of that kind of record keeping you can do. That's not to say you need to show your last year's worth of pay stubs, or I mean, time, clock in and clock out, but something. So get in the habit of doing that, especially if you're in a job that doesn't have a traditional timekeeping, like, you know, it's not a 9-to-5. If it's construction, or if it's a weird schedule where you're working different shifts every week, keep track of some stuff, because if you keep track of it and your employer says something else, then you have some leverage. The second thing I would say is to reach out to a worker center. Most cities have a worker center, but even if a city near you doesn't have a worker center, just find the closest one. If somebody calls me from Pittsburgh and says, at the Central Ohio Worker Center, and says, hey, I need some help, we're going to connect them to the right person. The worker centers more and more are getting connected regionally, and with partners that can kind of help direct, like, oh, there's not a worker center there, but talk to this person.
Yeah, we should take the terrorism message. If you see something, say something, because this is economic terrorism.
That's what I would do. I would take some notes, you know, write some stuff down, and then I'd reach out to a worker center because they're going to help you. They're going to help figure out what your right next step is to make sure you're not retaliated against and that you get your money.
There you go. Good stuff. And maybe reach out to the folks at Policy Matters Ohio.
Absolutely. We'll connect you.
There you go. The website, policymattersohio.org. Allie Smith, I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Appreciate you.
Good stuff. Make sure you check out the piece that they've got over at cleveland.com on this. We'll make sure we get links out on social media. We'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this date in labor history, the year was 1915. On this date, the most popular labor song in the United States was completed in Chicago. Ralph Chaplin, an industrial workers of the world activist, artist, and writer, was in town for a demonstration against hunger. He finished writing Solidarity Forever, a song he had started working on the year before at a miners' strike in West Virginia. Set to the popular tune John Brown's Body or the Battle Hymn of the Republic, the song became the anthem of the U.S. labor movement. Solidarity Forever continues to be a staple during countless union meetings, on picket lines, and May Day and Labor Day events throughout the nation. Also on this day in labor history, the year was 1963. On this day, President John F. Kennedy signed Executive Order 10988, which recognized the right of federal employees to join a union. The 1935 Wagner Act, which had ensured the right to organize a union, had excluded federal employees from that protection. Although they won the right to organize, under Kennedy's order, federal employees were denied the ability to go on strike. Even with this limitation, this executive order is considered very important in U.S. labor history. Not only did it allow federal employees to unionize, it also helped light a spark for public sector unionism at the state level. Today, approximately half of all union workers are in the public sector.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no greater power anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, you know, I look at this wage theft issue, and this is one of those things that, you know, no one should be on the wrong side of. If you work, you should be paid for it. And I've had people give me this, well, you know, overtime, you know, we can be flexible. No, the law is what the law is. I know that the right and corporate interests want to keep pushing this flexibility of, oh, we'll move overtime from 40 hours a week to, oh, I don't know, 160 hours a month. To which, if you can work 160 hours in a week, which they try and get you to do, you can't. But they would try just to cheat you out of the overtime. Look, I get being business friendly. I want businesses to be wildly profitable. I do. As a union guy, I want them to be as profitable as they can be. I want them to use my labor as effectively as possible to make themselves a great profit so that come negotiation times, we can sit down and I can get some of that. It's that, when the pie gets bigger kind of thing, you know, the George Bush, got to make the pie bigger. This is that. And we want more of it. The sad reality is, a lot of businesses go into business to figure out how to game the system, how to figure out how they're going to manipulate their workers, make them, you know, we're going to increase productivity quotas. We're gonna you know, cut around the edges. We'll have people work through breaks. You know, you name it, it's out there. And the sad reality is, too many people aren't empowered, or don't know that they're being cheated. And when this starts at a young age, understand that first job you get. Because, you know, during the break, I was thinking about it. I'm going, wait a second. You know, when I said I've never been cheated out of wages, that's not accurate. You know, I went back to when I was 16. You know, I started thinking, wait a second. No, I worked for a fast food place for a bit. I got stiffed there. I worked, you know, construction for a summer. That guy really, really stiffed me. Hold on. Wait a second. And I started thinking about it, going, wait a minute. No, there were a couple of times as a low-wage young worker where I've been cheated. Been a long time. Hasn't happened since. Learned the lesson. But when you're in that low-wage cycle, it becomes the cost of being poor. It becomes part of what you're accustomed to. You know, when you're down and everyone's kicking you, one more kick, I guess, isn't the end of the world. So when you start training young workers, like their first job, because everyone wants to do the best that they can do. Everyone starts that first job like a brand new baby with all the hope and opportunity and wide-eyed optimism that they can muster. And then over time, they're beaten down. But if you get those workers early and you start cheating them early to where they go, oh, this must be how it is. The boss wants me to come in 15 minutes early to set up and is not going to pay me. That just must be how it is. Ask anyone who works in a restaurant who has to come in and set up the tables and do all the prep work and don't get paid for it. If you get trained early to where, oh, well, you know, I'm just going to work through my lunch because, you know, my coworkers need me. You know, the boss needs me, you know, times. And you don't get your time off. You don't get paid for your breaks. You don't get those things. You start to get accustomed to getting ripped off. And yes, being forced to work through your break is a form of wage theft. That is time that is yours that you should be able to do what you need for yourself. But I know, no, you just got to be a good team player. I love this nonsense. Yeah, I want to be a good team player, but not at the expense of my family. And when you see these numbers, I mean, you know, I like the folks over at Policy Matter who put out this op-ed over at cleveland.com. I like the fact that they said, look, here's the image. Put this in your mind. All of these sports arenas, you know, the football field that the Browns play on, the baseball field that the Guardians play on, the basketball court the Cavs play at, you know, all of the high school football stadiums around the area, all of that, fill all those people to capacity, jam pack them with people. Those are the number of people who get ripped off every year just on minimum wage violations. That's not all of the overtime, the workers' comp, the unemployment. That's not any of that. The tax situation, it's none of that. And those are only people who are on the books. Those aren't the gig folks who are getting ripped off all the time, being told, hey, you're your own boss. I mean, we just had a president who, you know, in 2015, 2016, in the run-up to him being elected, I was talking to people every week about, yeah, I did work for Donald Trump. We did work on this tower or this place, and he cheated me. They sent me lawyers, and they bombarded us with, you know, with lawsuits, and we ended up, you know, settling out of court for pennies on the dollar. And you got it in our head, whoa, he's a smart businessman. He screwed over the little guy. That's why, to me, it's amazing to me that the working class of this country looks to him as someone who has their interests in mind. It's just mind-blowing to me when this is a guy who is engaged in massive wage theft. So what's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to finally say enough already? You know, like I said, you know, over my working career, other than those times as a teenager, I have not been cheated out of wages. And that's because of my union. That's because I've always had a voice on the job. I've always had the ability to say, hey, wait a second. You missed a spot here. And that has happened. You missed this trip. You missed this work. You missed this hour. Time to pay. And they do. You just got to stand up for it. You got to fight for it. And for me, that's what a union helps you do. empowerment. And that's what scares corporate America. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. Wherever you get yours, you'll find ours. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You are listening to WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, always streaming on the Civic Media app.